Yeah, I guess so. I remembered what he said to McGee when McGee asked him what had happened. It was in every story about the murders, just about. I couldn't help it. I tried to take it back, but it was too late. A man saying a thing like that with two little dead girls in his arms, them white and blonde, him as big as a house, no wonder they got it wrong. They heard what he was saying in a way that would agree with what they were seeing, and what they were seeing was black. They thought he was confessing that he was saying he'd had a compulsion to take those girls, rape them, and kill them, that he'd come to his senses and tried to stop. But by then it was too late, Brutal murmured. Yes. Except what he was really trying to tell them was that he'd found them, tried to heal them, to bring them back, and had no success. They were too far gone in death. Paul, do you believe that? Dean asked. Do you really, honest to God, believe that? I examined my heart as well as I could one final time, then nodded my head. Not only did I know it now, there was an intuitive part of me that had known something wasn't right with John Coffey's situation from the very beginning, when Percy had come onto the block, hauling on Coffey's arm and blaring, "Dead man walking," at the top of his lungs. I had shaken hands with him, hadn't I? I had never shaken the hand of a man coming on the Green Mile before, but I had shaken Coffey's. "Jesus," Dean said. "Good Jesus Christ." "Your shoe's one thing," Harry said. "What's the other?" Not long before the posse found Coffey and the girls, the men came out of the woods near the south bank of the Trepingus River. They found a patch of flattened-down grass there, a lot of blood, and the rest of Cora Dederick's nightie. The dogs got confused for a bit. Most wanted to go southeast, downstream along the bank, but two of them, the coon dogs, wanted to go upstream. Bobo Marchand was running the dogs, and when he gave the coonies a sniff of the nightgown, they turned with the others. "The coonies got mixed up, didn't they?" Brutal asked. A strange, sickened little smile was playing around the corners of his mouth. "They ain't built to be trackers, strictly speaking, and they got mixed up on what their job was." "Yes." "I don't get it," Dean said. "The coonies forgot whatever it was Bobo ran under their noses to get 'em started," Brutal said. "By the time they came out on the riverbank, the coonies were tracking the killer, not the girls. That wasn't a problem as long as the killer and the girls were together. But..." The light was dawning in Dean's eyes. Harry had already gotten it. "When you think about it," I said, "you wonder how anybody, even a jury wanting to pin the crime on a wandering black fellow, could have believed John Coffey was their man for even a minute. Just the idea of keeping the dog quiet with food until he could snap its neck would have been beyond Coffey. He was never any closer to the Dederick farm than the south bank of the Trepingus, that's what I think, 6 or more miles away. He was just mooning along, maybe meaning to go down to the railroad tracks and catch a freight to somewhere else. When they come off the trestle, they're going slow enough to hop, when he heard a commotion to the north. "The killer?" Brutal asked. "The killer. He might have raped them already, or maybe the rape was what Coffey heard. In any case, that bloody patch in the grass was where the killer finished the business, dashed their heads together, dropped them, and then hightailed it."
"Hightailed it northwest," Brutal said, "the direction the coon dogs wanted to go."
"Right. John Coffey comes through a stand of alders that grows a little way southeast of the spot where the girls were left, probably curious about all the noise, and he finds their bodies. One of them might still have been alive. I suppose it's possible both of them were, although not for much longer. John Coffey wouldn't have known if they were dead, that's for sure. All he knows is that he's got a healing power in his hands, and he tried to use it on Cora and Kathy Dederick. When it didn't work, he broke down, crying and hysterical, which is how they found him."
"Why didn't he stay there, where he found them?" Brutal asked. "Why take them south along the riverbank, any idea?"
"I bet he did stay put at first," I said. "At the trial they kept talking about a big, trampled area, all the grass squashed flat, and John Coffey's a big man."
"John Coffey's a fucking giant,"
Harry said, pitching his voice very low so my wife wouldn't hear him cuss if she happened to be listening.
Maybe he panicked when he saw that what he was doing wasn't working. Or maybe he got the idea that the killer was still there, in the woods, upstream, watching him. Coffee's big, you know, but not real brave. Harry, remember him asking if we left a light on in the block after bedtime?
Yeah. I remember thinking how funny that was, what with the size of him.
Harry looked shaken and thoughtful.
Well, if he didn't kill the little girls, who did?
Dean asked. I shook my head. Someone else. Someone white would be my best guess. The prosecutor made a big deal about how it would have taken a strong man to kill a dog as big as the one the Dedricks kept, but
that's crap, Brutus rumbled. A 12-year-old girl could break a big dog's neck if she took the dog by surprise and knew where to grab. If Coffee didn't do it, it could have been damn near anyone, any man, that is.
We'll probably never know, I said, unless he does it again.
We wouldn't know even then if he did it down Texas or in California, Harry said.
Brutal leaned back, screwed his fists into his eyes like a tired child, then dropped them into his lap again.
This is a nightmare, he said. We've got a man who may be innocent, who probably is innocent, and he's going to walk the green mile, just as sure as God made tall trees and little fishes. What are we supposed to do about it? If we start in with that healing finger shit, everyone's going to laugh their asses off, and he'll end up in the fryo later just the same.
Let's worry about that later, I said, because I didn't have the slightest idea how to answer him. The question right now is what we do, or don't do, about Melly. I'd say step back and take a few days to think it over, but I think every day we wait raises the chances that he won't be able to help her.
Remember him holding his hands out for the mouse? Brutal asked. Give him to me while there's still time, he said. While there's still time.
I remember. Brutal considered, then nodded.
I'm in. I feel bad about Mel, too, but mostly I think I just want to see what happens when he touches her.
Probably nothing will, but maybe...
I doubt like hell we even get the big dummy off the block, Harry said.
Then sighed and nodded.
But who gives a shit? Count me in.
Me too, Dean said.
Who stays on the block, Paul? Do we draw straws for it?
No, sir, I said. No straws. You stay.
Just like that?
The hell you say, Dean replied, hurt and angry. He whipped off his spectacles and began to polish them furiously on his shirt.
What kind of a bum deal is that?
The kind you get if you're young enough to have kids still in school, Brutal said. Harry and me's bachelors. Paul's married, but his kids are grown and off on their own, at least. This is a mucho crazy stunt we're planning here. I think we're almost sure to get caught.
He gazed at me soberly.
One thing you didn't mention, Paul, is that if we do manage to get him out of the slam and then Coffee's healing fingers don't work, Hal Moores is apt to turn us in himself.
He gave me a chance to reply to this, maybe to rebut it, but I couldn't, and so I kept my mouth shut. Brutal turned back to Dean and went on.
Don't get me wrong, you're apt to lose your job, too. But at least you'd have a chance to get clear of prison if the heat really came down. Percy's gonna think it was a prank. If you're on the duty desk, you can say you thought the same thing and we never told you any different.
I still don't like it,
Dean said. But it was clear he'd go along with it, like it or not. The thought of his kiddies had convinced him.
And it's to be tonight? You're sure?
If we're going to do it, it had better be tonight, Harry said. If I get a chance to think about it, I'll most likely lose my nerve.
Let me be the one to go by the infirmary, Dean said. I can do that much, at least, can I?
As long as you can do what needs doing without getting caught, Brutal said.
Dean looked offended, and I clapped him on the shoulder. As soon after you clock in as you can, all right?
You bet.
My wife popped her head through the door as if I'd given her a cue to do so.
"Who's for more iced tea?" she asked brightly. "What about you, Brutus?"
"No, thanks," he said. "What I'd like is a good hard knock of whiskey, but under the circumstances that might not be a good idea."
Janice looked at me, smiling mouth, worried eyes.
"What are you getting these boys into, Paul?"
But before I could even think of framing a reply, she raised her hand and said,
"Never mind, I don't want to know."
Chapter 3. Later, long after the others were gone and while I was dressing for work, she took me by the arm, swung me around, and looked into my eyes with fierce intensity.
"Melinda?"
she asked. I nodded.
"Can you do something for her, Paul? Really do something for her? Or is it all wishful dreaming brought on by what you saw last night?"
I thought of Coffee's eyes, of Coffee's hands, and of the hypnotized way I'd gone to him when he'd wanted me. I thought of him holding out his hand for Mr. Jingle's broken, dying body. "While there's still time," he had said, and the black swirling things that turned white and disappeared. "I think we might be the only chance she has left," I said at last.
"Then take it," she said, buttoning the front of my new fall coat.
It had been in the closet since my birthday at the beginning of September, but this was only the third or fourth time I had actually worn it.
"Take it."
And she practically pushed me out the door. Chapter 4. I clocked in that night, in many ways the strangest night of my entire life, at 6:20. I thought I could still smell the faint, lingering odor of burned flesh on the air. It had to be an illusion. The doors to the outside, both on the block and in the storage room, had been open most of the day, and the previous two shifts had spent hours scrubbing in there. But that didn't change what my nose was telling me, and I didn't think I could have eaten any dinner even if I hadn't been scared almost to death about the evening which lay ahead. Brutal came on the block at 6:45, Dean at 10 till. I asked Dean if he would go over to the infirmary and see if they had a heating pad for my back, which I seemed to have strained that early morning helping to carry Delacroix's body down into the tunnel. Dean said he'd be happy to. I believe he wanted to tip me a wink, but restrained himself. Harry clocked on at 6:03. "The truck?" I asked.
"Where we talked about?"
"So far, so good." There followed a little passage of time when we stood by the duty desk, drinking coffee and studiously not mentioning what we were all thinking and hoping, that Percy was late, that maybe Percy wasn't going to show up at all. Considering the hostile reviews he'd gotten on the way he'd handled the electrocution, that seemed at least possible. But Percy apparently subscribed to that old axiom about how you should get right back on the horse that had thrown you, because here he came through the door at 7:06, resplendent in his blue uniform, with his sidearm on one hip and his hickory stick in its ridiculous custom-made holster on the other. He punched his time card, then looked around at us warily, except for Dean, who hadn't come back from the infirmary yet.
"My starter busted," he said. "I had to crank." "Oh," Harry said, "poor baby."
"Should have stayed home and got the cussed thing fixed," Brutal said blandly. "We wouldn't want you straining your arm none, would we, boys?"
"Yeah, you'd like that, wouldn't you?"
Percy sneered, but I thought he seemed reassured by the relative mildness of Brutal's response. That was good. For the next few hours, we'd have to walk a line with him. Not too hostile, but not too friendly, either. After last night, he'd find anything even approaching warmth suspect. We weren't going to get him with his guard down, we all knew that, but I thought we could catch him with it a long piece from all the way up if we played things just right. It was important that we move fast, but it was also important, to me at least, that nobody be hurt, not even Percy Wetmore. Dean came back and gave me a little nod.
"Percy," I said, "I want you to go on in the storeroom and mop down the floor, stairs to the tunnel, too. Then you can write your report on last night."
"That should be creative,"
Brutal remarked, hooking his thumbs into his belt and looking up at the ceiling.
"You guys are funnier than a fucking church,"
Percy said. But beyond that, he didn't protest. Didn't even point out the obvious, which was that the floor in there had already been washed at least twice that day. My guess is that he was glad for the chance to be away from us. I went over the previous shift report, saw nothing that concerned me, and then took a walk down to Wharton's cell. He was sitting there on his bunk with his knees drawn up and his arms clasped around his shins, looking at me with a bright, hostile smile.
"Wow,"
"If it ain't the big boss," he said, "big as life and twice as ugly. You look happier than a pig knee-deep in shit, Boss Edgecombe. Wife give your pecker a pull before you left home, did she?"
"How you doing, kid?" I asked evenly, and at that he brightened for real. He let go of his legs, stood up, and stretched. His smile broadened, and some of the hostility went out of it.
"Well, damn," he said. "You got my name right for once. What's the matter with you, Boss Edgecombe? You sick or something?"
No, not sick. I'd been sick, but John Coffey had taken care of that. His hands no longer knew the trick of tying a shoe if they ever had, but they knew other tricks. Yes, indeed, they did. "My friend," I told him, "if you want to be a Billy the Kid instead of a Wild Bill, it's all the same to me." He puffed visibly, like one of those loathsome fish that live in South American rivers and can sting you almost to death with the spines along their backs and sides. I dealt with a lot of dangerous men during my time on the Mile, but few if any so repellent as William Wharton, who considered himself a great outlaw, but whose jailhouse behavior rarely rose above pissing or spitting through the bars of his cell. So far, we hadn't given him the awed respect he felt was his by right. But on that particular night, I wanted him tractable. If that meant lathering on the soft soap, I would gladly lather it on.
"I got a lot in common with the kid, and you just better believe it," Wharton said. "I didn't get here for stealing candy out of a dime store."
As proud as a man who's been conscripted into the Heroes Brigade of the French Foreign Legion, instead of one whose ass has been slammed into a cell 70 long steps from the electric chair.
"Where's my supper?"
"Come on, kid. Report says you had it at 5:50. Meatloaf with gravy, mashed peas. You don't con me that easy." He laughed expansively and sat down on his bunk again.
"Put on the radio, then."
He said radio in the way people did back then when they were joking, so it rhymed with the 50s slang word daddy-o. It's funny how much a person can remember about times when his nerves were tuned so tight they almost sang. "Maybe later, big boy," I said. I stepped away from his cell and looked down the corridor. Brutal had strolled down to the far end where he checked to make sure the restraint room door was on the single lock instead of the double. I knew it was because I'd already checked it myself. Later on, we'd want to be able to open that door as quick as we could. There would be no time spent emptying out the attic-type rickrack that had accumulated in there over the years. We'd taken it out, sorted it, and stored it in other places not long after Wharton joined our happy band. It had seemed to us the room with the soft walls was apt to get a lot of use, at least until Billy the Kid strolled the Mile. John Coffey, who would usually have been lying down at this time, long, thick legs dangling and face to the wall, was sitting on the end of his bunk with his hands clasped, watching Brutal with an alertness, a dareness that wasn't typical of him. He wasn't leaking around the eyes, either. Brutal tried the door to the restraint room, then came on back up the Mile. He glanced at Coffey as he passed Coffey's cell, and Coffey said a curious thing. "Sure, I'd like a ride," as if responding to something Brutal had said. Brutal's eyes met mine. "He knows," I could almost hear him saying. "Somehow he knows." I shrugged and spread my hands as if to say, "Of course he knows." Chapter 5. Old Toot Toot made his last trip of the night down to E Block with his cart at about 8:45. We bought enough of his crap to make him smile with avarice.
"Say, you boys seen that mouse?"
he asked. We shook our heads.
"Maybe Pretty Boy has," Toot said, and gestured with his head in the direction of the storage room, where Percy was either washing the floor, or writing his report, or picking his ass.
"What do you care? None of your affair either way," Brutal said. "Roll wheels, Toot. You're stinking the place up."
Toot smiled his peculiarly unpleasant smile, toothless and sunken, and made a business of sniffing the air.
"That ain't me you smell," he said. "That be Dell, saying so long."
Cackling, he rolled his cart out the door and into the exercise yard. And he went on rolling it for another 10 years, long after I was gone.
Hell, long after Cold Mountain was gone, selling moon pies and pops to the guards and prisoners who could afford them. Sometimes even now I hear him in my dreams, yelling that he's frying, he is frying, he's a dun-tum turkey. The time stretched out after Toot was gone, the clock seeming to crawl. We had the radio for an hour and a half. Wharton braying laughter at Fred Allen and Allen's Alley, even though I doubt like hell he understood many of the jokes. John Coffey sat on the end of his bunk, hands clasped, eyes rarely leaving whoever was at the duty desk. I've seen men waiting that way in bus stations for their buses to be called. Percy came in from the storage room around 10:45 and handed me a report which had been laboriously written in pencil. Eraser crumbs lay over the sheet of paper in gritty smears. He saw me run my thumb over one of these and said hastily, "That's just a first pass, like. I'm gonna copy it over. What do you think?" What I thought was that it was the most outrageous goddamn whitewash I'd read in all my born days. What I told him was that it was fine, and he went away satisfied. Dean and Harry played cribbage, talking too loud, squabbling over the count too often, and looking at the crawling hands of the clock every 5 seconds or so. On at least one of their games that night, they appeared to go around the board 3 times instead of 2. There was so much tension in the air that I felt I could almost have carved it like clay, and the only people who didn't seem to feel it were Percy and Wild Bill. When it got to be 10:50, I could stand it no longer and gave Dean a little nod. He went into my office with a bottle of R.C. Cola bought off Toot's cart and came back out a minute or two later. The cola was now in a tin cup, which a prisoner can't break and then slash with. I took it and glanced around. Harry, Dean, and Brutal were all watching me. So, for that matter, was John Coffey. Not Percy, though. Percy had returned to the storage room, where he probably felt more at ease on this particular night. I gave the tin cup a quick sniff and got no odor except for the R.C., which had an odd but pleasant cinnamon smell back in those days. I took it down to Wharton's cell. He was lying on his bunk. He wasn't masturbating, yet, anyway, but had raised quite a boner inside his shorts and was giving it a good healthy twang every now and again, like a dopey bass fiddler hammering an extra thick E string. "Kid," I said.
"Don't bother me," he said.
"Okay," I agreed. "I brought you a pop for behaving like a human being all night, damn near a record for you, but I'll just drink it myself." I made as if to do just that, raising the tin cup battered all up and down the sides from many angry bangings on many sets of cell bars to my lips. Wharton was off the bunk in a flash, which didn't surprise me. It wasn't a high-risk bluff. Most deep cons, lifers, rapists, and the men slated for Old Sparky are pigs for their sweets, and this one was no exception.
"Gimme that, ye clunk,"
Wharton said. He spoke as if he were the foreman and I was just another lowly peon.
"Give it to the kid."
I held it just outside the bars, letting him be the one to reach through. Doing it the other way around is a recipe for disaster, as any long-time prison screw will tell you. That was the kind of stuff we thought of without even knowing we were thinking of it. The way we knew not to let the cons call us by our first names. The way we knew that the sound of rapidly jingling keys meant trouble on the block, because it was the sound of a prison guard running, and prison guards never run unless there's trouble in the valley. Stuff Percy Wetmore was never going to get wise to. Tonight, however, Wharton had no interest in grabbing or choking. He snatched the tin cup, downed the pop in 3 long swallows, then voiced a resounding belch.
"Excellent," he said.
I held my hand out. "Cup." He held it for a moment, teasing with his eyes.
"Suppose I keep it?"
I shrugged. "We'll come in and take it back. You'll go down to the little room, and you will have drunk your last R.C., unless they serve it down in hell, of course." His smile faded.
"I don't like jokes about hell, Screwtip."
He thrust the cup out through the bars.
"Here, take it."
I took it. From behind me, Percy said,
"Why in God's name did you want to give a lagoon like him a soda pop?"
Because it was loaded with enough infirmary dope to put him on his back for 48 hours, and he never tasted a thing, I thought. With Paul, Brutal said, the quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth like the gentle rain from heaven.
Huh?
Percy asked, frowning.
Means he's a soft touch, always has been, always will be. Want to play a game of crazy eights, Percy?
Percy snorted.
Except for Go Fish and Old Maid, that's the stupidest card game ever made.
That's why I thought you might like a few hands, Brutal said, smiling sweetly.
Everybody's a Weisenheimer,
Percy said, and sulked off into my office. I didn't care much for the little rat parking his ass behind my desk, but I kept my mouth shut. The clock crawled. 12:20, 12:30. At 12:40, John Coffey got up off his bunk and stood at his cell door, hands grasping the bars loosely. Brutal and I walked down to Wharton's cell and looked in. He lay there on his bunk, smiling up at the ceiling. His eyes were open, but they looked like big glass balls. One hand lay on his chest, the other dangled limply off the side of his bunk, knuckles brushing the floor.
"Gosh," Brutal said. "From Billy the Kid to Willie the Weeper in less than an hour. I wonder how many of those morphine pills Dean put in that tonic."
"Enough," I said. There was a little tremble in my voice. I don't know if Brutal heard it, but I sure did. "Come on, we're going to do it."
"You don't want to wait for Beautiful there to pass out?"
"He's passed out now, Brute. He's just too buzzed to close his eyes."
"You're the boss."
He looked around for Harry, but Harry was already there. Dean was sitting bolt upright at the duty desk, shuffling the cards so hard and fast it was a wonder they didn't catch fire, throwing a little glance to his left at my office with every flutter shuffle, keeping an eye out for Percy.
"Is it time?"
Harry asked. His long, horsey face was very pale above his blue uniform blouse, but he looked determined. "Yes," I said. "If we're going through with it, it's time." Harry crossed himself and kissed his thumb. Then he went down to the restraint room, unlocked it, and came back with a straitjacket. He handed it to Brutal. The three of us walked up the green mile. Coffey stood at his cell door, watching us go, and said not a word. When we reached the duty desk, Brutal put the straitjacket behind his back, which was broad enough to conceal it easily. "Luck," Dean said. He was as pale as Harry and looked just as determined. Percy was behind my desk, all right, sitting in my chair and frowning over the book he'd been toting around with him the last few nights. Not Argosy or Stag, but Caring for the Mental Patient in Institutions. You would have thought, from the guilty, worried glance he threw our way when we walked in, that it had been the last days of Sodom and Gomorrah.
"What?"
he asked, closing the book in a hurry.
"What do you want?"
"To talk to you, Percy," I said. "That's all." But he read a hell of a lot more than a desire to talk on our faces, and was up like a shot, hurrying, not quite running, but almost toward the open door to the storeroom. He thought we had come to give him a ragging, at the very least, and more likely a good roughing up. Harry cut around behind him and blocked the doorway, arms folded on his chest.
"Say!"
Percy turned to me, alarmed but trying not to show it.
"What is this?"
"Don't ask, Percy," I said. I had thought I'd be okay. Back to normal, anyway, once we got rolling on this crazy business, but it wasn't working out that way. I couldn't believe what I was doing. It was like a bad dream. I kept expecting my wife to shake me awake and tell me I'd been moaning in my sleep. "It'll be easier if you just go along with it."
"What's Al got behind his back?"
Percy asked in a ragged voice, turning to get a better look at Brutal.
"Nothing,"
Brutal said.
"Well, this, I suppose."
He whipped the straitjacket out and shook it beside one hip, like a matador shaking his cape to make the bull charge. Percy's eyes widened, and he lunged. He meant to run, but Harry grabbed his arms, and a lunge was all he was able to manage.
"Let go of me!"
Percy shouted, trying to jerk out of Harry's grasp. It wasn't going to happen.
Harry outweighed him by almost 100 pounds, and had the muscles of a man who spent most of his spare time plowing and chopping. But Percy gave it a good enough effort to drag Harry halfway across the room and to rough up the unpleasant green carpet I kept meaning to replace. For a moment I thought he was even going to get one arm free. Panic can be one hell of a motivator. "Settle down, Percy," I said. "It'll go easier if you..."
"Don't you tell me to settle down, you ignoramus!"
Percy yelled, jerking his shoulders and trying to free his arms.
"Just get away from me, all of you! I know people, big people. If you don't quit this, you'll have to go all the way to South Carolina just to get a meal in a soup kitchen!"
He gave another forward lunge and ran his upper thighs into my desk. The book he'd been reading, Caring for the Mental Patient in Institutions, gave a jump, and the smaller pamphlet-sized book which had been hidden inside it popped out. No wonder Percy had looked guilty when we came in. It wasn't the last days of Sodom and Gomorrah, but it was the one we sometimes gave to inmates who were feeling especially horny and who had been well-behaved enough to deserve a treat. I've mentioned it, I think. The little cartoon book where Olive Oil does everybody except Sweet Pea the Kid. I found it sad that Percy had been in my office and pursuing such pallid porn, and Harry, when I could see of him from over Percy's straining shoulder, looked mildly disgusted. But Brutal hooted with laughter, and that took the fight out of Percy, at least for the time being.
"Oh, Percy," he said, "what would your mother say? For that matter, what would the governor say?"
Percy was blushing a dark red.
"Just shut up! And leave my mother out of it!"
Brutal tossed me the straitjacket and pushed his face up into Percy's. "Sure thing. Just stick out your arms like a good boy." Percy's lips were trembling and his eyes were too bright. He was, I realized, on the verge of tears.
"I won't,"
he said in a childish, trembling voice.
"And you can't make me."
Then he raised his voice and began to scream for help. Harry winced, and so did I. If we ever came close to just dropping the whole thing, it was then. We might have, except for Brutal. He never hesitated. He stepped behind Percy so he was shoulder to shoulder with Harry, who still had Percy's hands pinned behind him. Brutal reached up and took Percy's ears in his hands. "Stop that yelling," Brutal said, "unless you want to have a pair of the world's most unique teabag caddies." Percy quit yelling for help and just stood there, trembling and looking down at the cover of the crude cartoon book, which showed Popeye and Olive doing it in a creative way I had never tried.
"Ooh, Popeye," read the balloon over Olive's head.
"Uck-uck-uck-uck,"
read the one over Popeye's. He was still smoking his pipe. "Hold out your arms," Brutal said, "and let's have no more foolishness about it. Do it now."
"I won't,"
Percy said.
"I won't, and you can't make me."
"You're dead wrong about that, you know," Brutal said, then clamped down on Percy's ears and twisted them the way you might twist the dials on an oven that wasn't cooking the way you wanted. Percy let out a miserable shriek of pain and surprise that I would have given a great deal not to have heard. It wasn't just pain and surprise, you see. It was understanding. For the first time in his life, Percy was realizing that awful things didn't just happen to other people, those not fortunate enough to be related to the governor. I wanted to tell Brutal to stop, but of course I couldn't. Things had gone much too far for that. All I could do was to remind myself that Percy had put Delacroix through God knew what agonies simply because Delacroix had laughed at him. The reminder didn't go very far towards soothing the way I felt. Perhaps it might have if I'd been built more along the lines of Percy. "Stick those arms out there, honey," Brutal said, "or you get another." Harry had already let go of young Mr. Wetmore. Sobbing like a little kid, the tears which had been standing in his eyes now spilling down his cheeks, Percy shot his hands out straight in front of him like a sleepwalker in a movie comedy. I had the sleeves of the straitjacket up his arms in a trice. I hardly had it over his shoulders before Brutal had let go of Percy's ears and grabbed the straps hanging down from the jacket's cuffs. He yanked Percy's hands around to his side so that his arms were crossed tightly on his chest. Harry, meanwhile, did up the back and snapped the cross straps. Once Percy gave in and stuck out his arms, the whole thing took less than 10 seconds.
"Okay, hon," Brutal said. "Forward hatch!"
But he wouldn't. He looked at Brutal, then turned his terrified, streaming eyes on me. Nothing about his connections now, or how we'd have to go all the way to South Carolina just to get a free meal. He was far past that.
"Please," he whispered in a hoarse, wet voice. "Don't put me in with him, Paul!"
Then I understood why he had panicked, why he'd fought us so hard. He thought we were going to put him in with Wild Bill Wharton, that his punishment for the dry sponge was to be a dry cornholing from the resident psychopath. Instead of feeling sympathy for Percy at this realization, I felt disgust and a hardening of my resolve. He was, after all, judging us by the way he would have behaved had our positions been reversed.
"Not Wharton," I said. "The restraint room, Percy. You're going to spend 3 or 4 hours in there all by yourself in the dark, thinking about what you did to Dell. It's probably too late for you to learn any new lessons about how people are supposed to behave. Brute thinks so anyway, but I'm an optimist. Now move."
He did, muttering under his breath that we'd be sorry for this, plenty sorry, just wait and see. But on the whole, he seemed relieved and reassured. When we herded him out into the hall, Dean gave us a look of such wide-eyed surprise and dewy innocence that I could have laughed if the business hadn't been so serious. I've seen better acting in Backwoods Grange reviews.
"Say, don't you think the joke's gone far enough?" Dean asked.
"You just shut up if you know what's good for you," Brutal growled.
These were lines we'd scripted at lunch, and that was just what they sounded like to me, scripted lines. But if Percy was scared enough and confused enough, they still might save Dean Stanton's job in a pinch. I myself didn't think so, but anything was possible. Any time I've doubted that, then or since, I just think about John Coffey and Delacroix's mouse. We ran Percy down the Green Mile, him stumbling and gasping for us to slow down. He was going to go flat on his face if we didn't slow down. Wharton was on his bunk, but we went by too fast for me to see if he was awake or asleep. John Coffey was standing at his cell door and watching.
"You're a bad man, and you deserve to go in that dark place," he said, but I don't think Percy heard him.
Into the restraint room we went. Percy's cheeks red and wet with tears, his eyes rolling in their sockets, his pampered locks all flopping down on his forehead. Harry pulled Percy's gun with one hand and his treasured hickory head knocker with the other.
"You'll get him back, don't worry," Harry said.
He sounded a trifle embarrassed.
"I wish I could say the same about your job," Percy replied. "All your jobs. You can't do this to me. You can't."
He was obviously prepared to go on in that vein for quite a while, but we didn't have time to listen to his sermon. In my pocket was a roll of friction tape, the 30s ancestor of the strapping tape folks use today. Percy saw it and started to back away. Brutal grabbed him from behind and hugged him until I had slapped the tape over his mouth, winding the roll around to the back of his head just to be sure. He was going to have a few less swatches of hair when the tape came off, and a pair of seriously chapped lips into the bargain. But I no longer much cared. I'd had a gutful of Percy Wetmore. We backed away from him. He stood in the middle of the room under the caged light, wearing the straitjacket, breathing through flared nostrils and making muffled sounds from behind the tape. All in all, he looked as crazy as any other prisoner we'd ever jugged in that room. "The quieter you are, the sooner you get out," I said. "Try to remember that, Percy."
"And if you get lonely, think about olive oil," Harry advised. "Look."
Then we went out. I closed the door and Brutal locked it. Dean was standing a little way up the mile, just outside of Coffey's cell. He had already put the master key in the top lock. The four of us looked at each other, no one saying anything. There was no need to. We had started the machinery. All we could do now was hope that it ran the course we had laid out instead of jumping the tracks somewhere along the line.
"You still want to go for that ride, John?" Brutal asked.
Yes, sir, Coffey said. I reckon.
Good, Dean said. He turned the first lock, removed the key, and seated it in the second.
Do we need to chain you up, John? I asked.
Coffey appeared to think about this.
Can if you want to, he said at last. Don't need to.
I nodded at Brutal, who opened the cell door, then turned to Harry, who was more or less pointing Percy's 45 at Coffey as Coffey emerged from his cell.
Give those to Dean, I said.
Harry blinked, like someone awakening from a momentary doze, saw Percy's gun and stick still in his hands, and passed them over to Dean. Coffey, meanwhile, hulked in the corridor with his bald skull almost brushing one of the caged overhead lights. Standing there with his hands in front of him and his shoulders sloped forward to either side of his barrel chest, he made me think again, as I had the first time I saw him, of a huge captured bear.
Lock Percy's toys in the duty desk until we get back, I said.
If we get back, Harry added.
I will, Dean said to me, taking no notice of Harry.
And if someone shows up, probably no one will, but if someone does, what do you say?
That Coffey got upset around midnight, Dean said. He looked as studious as a college student taking a big exam. We had to give him the jacket and put him in the restraint room. If there's noise, whoever hears it'll just think it's him.
He raised his chin at John Coffey.
And what about us? Brutal asked.
Paul's over in admin, pulling Dell's file and going over the witnesses, Dean said. It's especially important this time, because the execution was such a balls-up. He said he'd probably be there the rest of the shift. You and Harry and Percy are over in the laundry washing your clothes.
Well, that was what folks said, anyway. There was a crap game in the laundry supply room some nights. On others it was blackjack, or poker, or AC-Doocy. Whatever it was, the guards who participated were said to be washing their clothes. There was usually moonshine at these get-togethers, and on occasion a joystick would go around the circle. It's been the same in prisons since prisons were invented, I suppose. When you spend your life taking care of mud men, you can't help getting a little dirty yourself. In any case, we weren't likely to be checked up on. Clothes washing was treated with great discretion at Cold Mountain.
Right with Eversharp, I said, turning Coffey around and putting him in motion.
And if it all falls down, Dean, you don't know nothing about nothing.
That's easy to say, but at that moment a skinny arm shot out from between the bars of Wharton's cell and grabbed Coffey's slab of a bicep. We all gasped. Wharton should have been dead to the world, all but comatose, yet here he stood, swaying back and forth on his feet like a hard-tagged fighter, grinning blearily.
Coffey's reaction was remarkable. He didn't pull away, but he also gasped, pulling air in over his teeth like someone who has touched something cold and unpleasant. His eyes widened, and for a moment he looked as if he and Dumb had never even met, let alone got up together every morning and lain down together every night. He had looked alive, there, when he had wanted me to come into his cell so he could touch me, help me, in Coffey speak. He had looked that way again when he'd been holding his hands out for the mouse. Now, for the third time, his face had lit up as if a spotlight had suddenly been turned on inside his brain. Except it was different this time. It was colder this time, and for the first time I wondered what might happen if John Coffey were suddenly to run amok. We had our guns, we could shoot him, but actually taking him down might not be easy to do. I saw similar thoughts on Brutal's face, but Wharton just went on grinning his stoned, loose-lipped grin.
"Where do you think you're gone?" he asked.
It came out something like, "Where do you think you're gone?" Coffey stood still, looking first at Wharton, then at Wharton's hand, then back into Wharton's face. I could not read that expression. I mean, I could see the intelligence in it, but I couldn't read it. As for Wharton, I wasn't worried about him at all. He wouldn't remember any of this later. He was like a drunk walking in a blackout.
"You're a bad man," Coffey whispered, and I couldn't tell what I heard in his voice. Pain or anger or fear. Maybe all three.
Coffee looked down at the hand on his arm again, the way you might look at a bug which could give you a really nasty bite, had it a mind.
"That's right, nigger,"
Wharton said with a bleary, cocky smile.
"Bad as you'd want."
I was suddenly positive that something awful was going to happen, something that would change the planned course of this early morning as completely as a cataclysmic earthquake can change the course of a river. It was going to happen, and nothing I or any of us did would stop it. Then Brutal reached down, plucked Wharton's hand off John Coffey's arm, and that feeling stopped. It was as if some potentially dangerous circuit had been broken. I told you that in my time in E-Block, the governor's line never rang. That was true, but I imagine that if it ever had, I would have felt the same relief that washed over me when Brutal removed Wharton's hand from the big man towering beside me. Coffee's eyes dulled over at once. It was as if the searchlight inside his head had been turned off. "Lie down, Billy," Brutal said. "Take you some rest." That was my usual line of patter, but under the circumstances, I didn't mind Brutal using it.
"Maybe I will,"
Wharton agreed. He stepped back, swayed, almost went over, and caught his balance at the last second.
"Woo, Daddy! Whole room's spinning around. Like being drunk."
He backed toward his bunk, keeping his bleary regard on Coffee as he went.
"Niggers ought to have their own electric chair,"
he opined. Then the backs of his knees struck his bunk and he swooped down onto it. He was snoring before his head touched his thin prison pillow. Deep blue shadows brushed under the hollows of his eyes and the tip of his tongue lolling out.
"Christ, how'd he get up with so much dope in him?"
Dean whispered. "It doesn't matter. He's out now," I said. "If he starts to come around, give him another pill dissolved in a glass of water. No more than one, though. We don't want to kill him."
"Speak for yourself," Brutal rumbled and gave Wharton a contemptuous look. "You can't kill a monkey like him with dope anyway. They thrive on it."
"He's a bad man," Coffee said, but in a lower voice this time, as if he was not quite sure of what he was saying or what it meant.
"That's right," Brutal said. "Most wicked. But that's not a problem now, because we ain't gonna tango with him anymore."
We started walking again, the four of us surrounding Coffee like worshippers circling an idol that's come to some stumbling kind of half-life.
"Tell me something, John. Do you know where we're taking you?"
"To help," he said. "I think... to help a lady?"
He looked at Brutal with hopeful anxiety. Brutal nodded.
"That's right. But how do you know that? How do you know?"
John Coffey considered the question carefully, then shook his head.
"I don't know," he told Brutal. "To tell you the truth, boss, I don't know much of anything. Never have." And with that, we had to be content.
Chapter 6. I had known the little door between the office and the steps down to the storage room hadn't been built with the likes of Coffee in mind, but I hadn't realized how great the disparity was until he stood before it, looking at it thoughtfully. Harry laughed, but John himself seemed to see no humor in the big man standing in front of the little door. He wouldn't have, of course. Even if he'd been quite a few degrees brighter than he was, he wouldn't have. He'd been that big man for most of his life, and this door was just a scrap littler than most. He sat down, scooted through it that way, stood up again, and went down the stairs to where Brutal was waiting for him. There he stopped, looking across the empty room at the platform where old Sparky waited, as silent and as eerie as the throne in the castle of a dead king. The cap hung with hollow jauntiness from one of the back posts, looking less like a king's crown than a jester's cap, however, something a fool would wear, or shake, to make his high-born audience laugh harder at his jokes. The chair's shadow, elongated and spidery, climbed one wall like a threat. And yes, I thought I could still smell burned flesh in the air. It was faint, but I thought it was more than just my imagination. Harry ducked through the door, then me. I didn't like the frozen, wide-eyed way John was looking at old Sparky. Even less did I like what I saw on his arms when I got close to him. Goosebumps. "Come on, big boy," I said. I took his wrist and attempted to pull him in the direction of the door leading down to the tunnel. At first he wouldn't go, and I might as well have been trying to pull a boulder out of the ground with my bare hands.
"Come on, John, we gotta go, unless you want the coaching four to turn back into a pumpkin,"
Harry said, giving his nervous laugh again. He took John's other arm and tugged, but John still wouldn't come. And then he said something in a low and dreaming voice. It wasn't me he was speaking to. It wasn't any of us. But I have still never forgotten it.
"They're still in there. Pieces of 'em. Still in there. I hear 'em screaming."
Harry's nervous chuckles ceased, leaving him with a smile that hung on his mouth like a crooked shutter hangs on an empty house. Brutal gave me a look that was almost terrified and stepped away from John Coffey. For the second time in less than 5 minutes, I sensed the whole enterprise on the verge of collapse. This time I was the one who stepped in. When disaster threatened a third time, a little later on, it would be Harry. We all got our chance that night, believe me. I slid in between John and his view of the chair, standing on my tiptoes to make sure I was completely blocking his sightline. Then I snapped my fingers in front of his eyes twice, sharply. "Come on," I said. "Walk. You said you didn't need to be chained. Now prove it. Walk, big boy. Walk, John Coffey, over there, that door." His eyes cleared.
"Yes, boss."
And praise God, he began to walk. "Look at the door, John Coffey. Just at the door, and nowhere else."
"Yes, boss."
John fixed his eyes obediently on the door. "Brutal," I said, and pointed. He hurried in advance, shaking out his key ring, finding the right one. John kept his gaze fixed on the door to the tunnel, and I kept my gaze fixed on John. But from the corner of one eye, I could see Harry throwing nervous glances at the chair, as if he had never seen it before in his life. "There are pieces of them still in there. I hear them screaming." If that was true, then Edouard Delacroix had to be screaming longest and loudest of all, and I was glad I couldn't hear what John Coffey did. Brutal opened the door. We went down the stairs with Coffey in the lead. At the bottom, he looked glumly down the tunnel with its low brick ceiling. He was going to have a crick in his back by the time we got to the other end, unless I pulled the gurney over. The sheet upon which we'd laid Dell had been stripped and probably incinerated, so the gurney's black leather pads were visible. "Get on," I told John. He looked at me doubtfully, and I nodded encouragement. "It'll be easier for you, and no harder for us."
"Okay, Boss Edgecombe."
He sat down, then lay back, looking up at us with worried brown eyes. His feet, clad in cheap prison slippers, dangled almost all the way to the floor. Brutal got in between them and pushed John Coffey along the dank corridor as he had pushed so many others. The only difference was that the current rider was still breathing. About halfway along, under the highway we would have been, and able to hear the muffled drone of passing cars, had there been any at that hour, John began to smile.
"Say," he said, "this is fun."
You wouldn't think so the next time he rode the gurney. That was the thought which crossed my mind.
In fact, the next time he rode the gurney, he wouldn't feel anything. Or would he? There are pieces of them still in there, he had said. He could hear them screaming. Walking behind the others and unseen by them, I shivered. I hope you remembered Aladdin, Boss Edgecombe, Brutal said as we reached the far end of the tunnel. Don't worry, I said. Aladdin looked no different from the other keys I carried in those days, and I had a bunch that must have weighed 4 pounds. But it was the master key of master keys, the one that opened everything. There was one Aladdin key for each of the 5 cell blocks in those days, each the property of the block super. Other guards could borrow it, but only the bull goose screw didn't have to sign it out. There was a steel-barred gate at the far end of the tunnel. It always reminded me of pictures I'd seen of old castles, you know, in days of old when knights were bold and chivalry was in flower. Only Cold Mountain was a long way from Camelot. Beyond the gate, a flight of stairs led up to an unobtrusive bulkhead-style door with signs reading No Trespassing and State Property and Electrified Wire on the outside. I opened the gate and Harry swung it back. We went up, John Coffey once more in the lead, shoulders slumped and head bent. At the top, Harry got around him, not without some difficulty either, although he was the smallest of the three of us, and unlocked the bulkhead. It was heavy. He could move it, but wasn't able to flip it up. "Here, boss," John said. He pushed to the front again, bumping Harry into the wall with one hip as he did so, and raised the bulkhead with one hand. You would have thought it was painted cardboard instead of sheet steel. Cold night air, moving with the ridge-running wind we would now get most of the time until March or April, blew down into our faces. A swirl of dead leaves came with it, and John Coffey caught one of them with his free hand. I will never forget the way he looked at it, or how he crumpled it beneath his broad, handsome nose so it would release its smell. "Come on," Brutal said. "Let's go. Forward hatch." We climbed out. John lowered the bulkhead and Brutal locked it. No need for the Aladdin key on this door, but it was needed to unlock the gate in the pole and wire cage which surrounded the bulkhead.
"Hands to your sides while you go through, big fella," Harry murmured. "Don't touch the wire if you don't want a nasty burn."
Then we were clear, standing on the shoulder of the road in a little cluster, 3 foothills around a mountain, is what I imagine we looked like, staring across at the walls and lights and guard towers of Cold Mountain Penitentiary. I could actually see the vague shape of a guard inside one of those towers, blowing on his hands, but only for a moment. The road-facing windows in the towers were small and unimportant. Still, we would have to be very, very quiet. And if a car did come along now, we could be in deep trouble.
"Come on," I whispered. "Lead the way, Harry."
We slunk north along the highway in a little conga line, Harry first, then John Coffey, then Brutal, then me. We breasted the first rise and walked down the other side, where all we could see of the prison was the bright glow of the lights and the tops of the trees. And still Harry led us onward.
"Where'd you park it?"
Brutal Stage whispered, vapor puffing from his mouth in a white cloud.
"Baltimore?"
"It's right up ahead,"
Harry replied, sounding nervous and irritable.
"Hold your damn water, Brutus."
But Coffey, from what I'd seen of him, would have been happy to walk until the sun came up, maybe until it went back down again. He looked everywhere, starting, not in fear, but in delight, I'm quite sure, when an owl hooed. It came to me that while he might be afraid of the dark inside, he wasn't afraid of it out here. Not at all. He was caressing the night, rubbing his senses across it, the way a man might rub his face across the swells and concavities of a woman's breasts.
"We turn here," Harry muttered.
A little finger of road, narrow, unpaved, weeds running up the center crown, angled off to the right. We turned up this and walked another quarter of a mile. Brutal was beginning to grumble again when Harry stopped, went to the left side of the track, and began to remove sprays of broken-off pine boughs. John and Brutal pitched in, and before I could join them, they had uncovered the dented snout of an old farm-all truck, its wired-on headlights staring at us like buggy eyes.
I wanted to be as careful as I could, you know,
Harry said to Brutal in a thin, scolding voice.
This may be a big joke to you, Brutus Howe, but I come from a very religious family. I got cousins back in the holler so damn holy they make the Christians look like lions, and if I get caught playing at something like this...
It's okay, Brutal said. I'm just jumpy, that's all.
Me too,
Harry said stiffly.
Now if this cussed old thing will just start...
He walked around the hood of the truck, still muttering, and Brutal tipped me a wink. As far as coffee was concerned, we had ceased to exist,